Welcome to the Total Bitcoin Podcast Show. My name is Kevan Devani. This next talk is going to be with Neil Woodfine. We're looking forward to that. He has got a profound knowledge of Bitcoin, the ethical principles of Bitcoin, the vision, the ethos. So check out definitely his Twitter handle is nwoodfine. And there was recently or some time ago a Twitter thread. Storm, which went pretty viral, about what happens when the internet shuts down and or power grid shuts off. So he had done a presentation in October 2019 in Switzerland, Zurich, on the technological options possibilities, and which is pretty good summarized in the article decrypt.co with the title, What Good is Bitcoin If the Internet Fails? Blockstream's Neil Woodfine lays out the solutions developers are working on to make Bitcoin impervious to interference. And, I think he's pretty much on the same page as I am, that I think critical adoption, mass adoption is truly possible. And the technology just needs to mature, of course, and to process and to develop. But he's also of the opinion when it comes to things like custody, surveillance, privacy, all these things, there are possibilities to or security, So he is also of the opinion that that the tools are realistically realistic to build and to implement. And education, of course, is paramount to this whole thing, but making the tools more easily accessible is really the way to go. And yeah, without further ado, I hope you're gonna love this as much as I'm gonna do. And please leave me any positive review. I would really appreciate that on any podcast platform. Write me to hello@thetotalconnector.com. Without further ado, this is my talk with Neil Woodfine. Thank you so much for listening, for support.
Hey Neil, welcome to the show, to the Total Bitcoin Show. How are you doing, man?
Hi Kevan, doing really good, thanks. And thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thank you for your time. Listen, Neil, so I've had, I've been following you, for some time now, and your one of your Twitter threads, which is based actually on the presentation you gave in Zurich, I think, right? It was last October.
That's right, yeah.
In Switzerland, yeah. So it was just to break it down, for my listeners, it was about the topic was, what if the internet breaks down, or there's a shutdown, or there's a shutdown of the power grid? What are the options? What are the technological realistic possibilities? And it was also pretty good summarized in an article on decrypt.co, What Good is Bitcoin If the Internet Fails? With the subtitle Blockstream's Neil Woodfine lays out the solutions developers are working on to make Bitcoin impervious to interference. Now, before we go into all kinds of details, Neil, for my listeners who might not have heard, but I'm sure most of my listeners do know you, what I'm really curious about, what's your background? I know you're in the marketing department of Blockstream. But what's your path to Bitcoin? What is your vision? What was the aha moment when you understood Bitcoin? And yeah, just tell me a little bit about yourself. Thanks so much.
No worries. So like many others, I got into Bitcoin because the price was going up. That was in 2013. I very quickly became completely obsessed, partly because I caught the tail end of the bull run in 2013, which was obviously very exciting. And that sent me kind of on a research spree where I spent a lot of my days reading about Bitcoin. It got me hooked. So when the price started going down, it wasn't a big deal for me. I was kind of convinced that this was kind of a technology with a lot of promise. And I decided, so I was working in the manufacturing industry in China at the time, in cement. And I decided that I had to get into the Bitcoin industry at all costs. Obviously it looked a lot more exciting and probably a lot of interesting opportunities in the future. So I joined OKCoin, starting off as pretty much just kind of like a customer service rep. And then quickly moving on to doing business development. I left OKCoin after a year, started a cross-border payments startup called Remitzy with one of my OKCoin colleagues, Richard Bensberg. We did that for a year and a bit, and then we sold that to a company called Wire. We worked at Wire for a year and then left that, and now I'm working at Blockstream doing marketing. And during that time, I've been consistently obsessed with Bitcoin, both at work and in my personal life. I used to run the Bitcoin meetup in Beijing for 4 years before leaving, and now run a very small Bitcoin-only meetup in Chiang Mai, where I'm based.
And you speak Chinese, as we've just been talking before. It's
yes, I speak Chinese after a good few years living there.
What other languages do you speak besides Chinese?
Just English and Chinese. I learned French at school for 5 years and I've forgotten all of it.
Okay, cool.
So I'm happy to stick to two.
Okay. No, that's really, you know, being in command of a especially exotic language. I mean, I would call it exotic, you know, like Chinese is really precious. You know, it's like nobody can take it away from you. It's, you can get anywhere, right, with this language, especially, you know, if you're sort of like a native speaker to them.
Yes, it's very useful. And I think increasingly, so I've been speaking it for like 14 years or something now. Increasingly, I'm discovering that more and more kind of non-Chinese people are also able to speak Chinese if they can't speak good English. So it's useful for communicating in Thailand, for instance. Sometimes you can find somebody who'll speak Chinese but not speak good English. So, it's definitely kind of becoming an international language. And then even without that, you can speak to 1.3, 1.4 billion people, right?
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. So Neil, I've had the chance to, my last interviews, talk to Richard Myers from Global Mesh Lab Networks, Randy Brito. Excellent. Yeah. Randy Brito of Lotcha Mesh. And, those are like the most important figures when it comes to, you know, to developing technology, practical technology, you know, for the average, not only average, but, you know, people in disenfranchised countries or countries where there's sanctions, or Iran, where there was, you know, internet shutdown down to 3-4% or even lower. Now it's back up again, but, you know, it's about surveillance, censorship, sanctions, countries with inflation, hyperinflation. So without further ado, Neil, can you, a little bit before we go into my questions, give a little bit of still a brief overview. What was the intention behind that presentation you gave in Zurich, and, you know, the triple threat about what is possible, you know, with local mesh networks, low bandwidth radio signals, Blockstream satellites? What is practical? What is realistic right now?
I've been working at Blockstream for almost a year and a half now. And Blockstream satellite was something that I was familiar with, but hadn't really got very close to. I used to get asked a lot of questions about it. It gets us in the media quite a lot. Like, Bitcoin satellites are quite like a sexy proposition. So I was speaking to the guys at the Swiss Bitcoin Association, and they were interested in having me over to talk, and we were like working out some potential topics, and satellite was one of the top of the, well, it's basically top of the list. So I was like, okay, I'll give that a shot. And I realized to be able to do the presentation, I was going to have to do a lot more research. I didn't want to just focus on Blockstream technology, because I didn't want to just do kind of an advertorial when I went there. So I decided, like, let's tie this into a broader subject of using Bitcoin without the internet. And so I spent like a couple of days doing a bunch of research, and I realized like how interesting all of this was, how important Blockstream satellite was as a piece of the puzzle for making Bitcoin accessible and operational offline. So I put together the presentation, present it in Switzerland, and then I just figured it was an interesting topic to do a tweet storm on. I'd been thinking about it a little bit more after the event. So I put it out there. It's something that I've been putting off for a while. I think it was quite a big, it was like 2 or 3 months between the actual presentation and my tweet storm. But it was worthwhile. I got a good response on the tweet storm. And I think it really helped people understand where Blockstream Satellite fits into all of this, but also kind of how resilient the Bitcoin network already is against potential threats, such as like internet outages, government interventions, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Now in your presentation or in the article, which is pretty good summarized, there is a point where one has to think about, I call it like independence from the internet, but somewhere along those lines, would you need like at least one basic internet connection to connect it in principle to the mesh network? Or can you like elaborate a little bit, like how independent is it really from the internet nowadays?
Yeah. So, I mean, if the entire internet went down for whatever reason, Bitcoin would be in serious trouble. There's no getting around that fact. And despite the fact that the presentation was described as offline Bitcoin solutions, it's really internet minimized rather than purely offline. For instance, mesh networks would be considered a last mile technology. So they allow people at the edges of the network to transact, but those transactions ultimately need to be broadcast onto the internet at some point so that they can reach the Bitcoin miners, so that they can be mined onto the blockchain. And then the Blockstream Satellite is just there to run a full node and verify all of the transactions without the internet. It doesn't solve that problem of getting the actual committed transactions to the blockchain. And to get those transactions to the blockchain, the pretty much the only kind of scalable solution is the internet. Potentially, you could maybe use radio to do that. Like you could have like a radio access point, and that broadcasts the transactions around the world, and then that's picked up by miners to mine on the blockchain. It would be very difficult to construct a workable, serviceable network without the internet existing somewhere, basically.
Okay, so you need somewhere, somehow, a principal point of connection. Because I'm not a techie, so if there's, like in Iran was like a total, not a total, but like almost 97-98% internet shutdown, but there is still, that's what I'm trying to figure out, like, is it really that hard then to find some access point to the internet, or just to...
Yeah, okay. So, let's not use any specific country as an example, but let's just say country X doesn't have any internet. Now, maybe it doesn't have the infrastructure, or it's been shut down by a government. You could have a local community using a mesh network to communicate transactions to each other. But the problem is there. So if I receive a transaction from you across this mesh network, how do I know that this transaction has gone through and has been mined onto the Bitcoin network? I need to be able to verify that on my full node. My full node needs a copy of the most current blockchain. So the way to solve that is to set up, if I'm sending the transaction to you, you would set up a Blockstream Satellite. The Blockstream Satellite would download the latest blockchain data onto your Bitcoin full node, and any transaction that I sent to you, you could verify that has actually been applied to the Bitcoin blockchain. But the question is, for the transaction that I sent to you, how do we get that onto the internet in the first place? Mm-hmm. And the only way to do that is for us to send that completed transaction across the mesh network. Maybe it does 3 hops, 4 hops, 5 hops. It finally gets to a relay, and that person somehow has got a connection to the internet. So they may have, for instance, the easiest thing is that they just got a broadband connection for whatever reason. And that means that we've got this whole community connected to the Bitcoin network through one internet connection. Or if they don't have an internet connection, they could have something called an Iridium Go, which is a two-way satellite internet connection. So they can use the internet without without having some kind of cable plugged into their home. Another solution that they might have is just SMS. So they could receive those transactions from this mesh network to a mobile phone. The internet network is down, but the SMS network is available. They can send each one of those transactions in parts as SMS to somewhere else, perhaps somewhere else in the world or somewhere else in the country where that person has a connection to the internet, and then they relay that to the internet and to the Bitcoin miners. And then potentially another solution to that is if you had somebody with a amateur radio, ham radio, they could receive those transactions, bundle them up, and then broadcast them over the radio connection to somebody that has an internet connection, or just directly to the miners. But like, you've got that two kind of ends of the network. So the first one is downloading the blockchain and verifying transactions, and that's handled by Blockstream Satellite. And at the other edge, you've got relaying the transactions to the network, and at that point you need somebody with an internet connection.
Okay.
In the middle, so, you've got the mesh network.
Mm-hmm. So basically you're saying there's always a possibility if there's people with a little bit of technical experience and expertise or whatever, or knowledge, or you know how to do this, because it's not, I guess this is not for average, you know, people who can set up let's say you know, something like that,
a relay, right? Yeah, a relay. So I mean, yeah, so if you think about it, like your internet connection, you have no idea how that works. Yeah, so you have no idea how your internet connection works, and you speak to and you go to an ISP, and the ISP provides you the internet. You don't need to know, and they do that because you're going to pay them a fee. And in the same way, like if there is this situation, there is going to be a demand for Bitcoin usage, and people will demand relays. And if there's demand there, then the anybody running a relay could potentially run a business out of that. So they could charge a fee to be able to send a transaction over the network, for instance. And there's some really cool ways of doing that, which I mentioned in the presentation and also in the TweetStorm. So using partially signed Bitcoin transactions, you can construct a transaction in two parts. So if I'm sending the transaction to you, I would like say like send 0.01 Bitcoin to you, but then I could also add a relay fee of 0.001 Bitcoin, which can be picked up by anybody that relays that transaction. And the way that I do that is that I create two outputs in the transaction, and the second output, I send that to a public private key. So the private key is known. But the only way for anybody to be able to spend that is for them to relay the entire transaction onto the internet. So it kind of incentivizes this kind of activity. I think also when you're in a country where times are difficult and people are having a hard time for whatever reason, there's also just kind of a lot of reciprocity and people kind of doing good things for each other. For instance, I think in Iran, previously, when the internet was shut down, there were people relaying tweets by SMS to people that were connected to the internet for those tweets to go out, so that like messages were able to reach the wider world. And I'm not sure if people were charging money to do that. People were probably just doing it because they believed in the cause. And you could expect that happening with Bitcoin too. But even if it didn't, there would be a business there for somebody if they were interested in taking it.
Right. I get it. Yeah. Gotcha. So it's a pretty good transition, I think, to this subtopic, because I like that tweet that you did on January 30th. You wrote, what's bad? Custody, surveillance, per security. And then you wrote, okay, now make tools that make the opposite of these things easy. Making the tool successfully is hard, but imagining that these tools might exist in the future is not that hard. So Neil, I think I have a good feeling with you. I think we are on the same page when it comes to, you know, alleviate, or what do you call it, transitioning or accelerating, smoothening the access to this technology to the average user out there. So, are you also on the conviction that it is possible to make it easier. Whether we're talking about user experience, user interface, by default functions and features, tools, technological tools. What do you think in general about critical adoption and you know, making the tools?
Yeah, so I think these days a lot of people like discuss how do we drive Bitcoin adoption, and I think that's, I keep on feeling that's the wrong way to approach the problem. Like, who is the we, and like, why are we driving like all of these other people that perhaps don't want Bitcoin right now to use it? I think it's far more interesting to think from a different angle, which is, here's this awesome invention that can solve a lot of people's problems. How do I create a service that solves people's problems, like in a new way with Bitcoin? And there's like business opportunities there. So like, rather than this like kind of selfless act where we kind of all just kind of like talk about UX and like how Bitcoin needs to be easier and stuff like that, let's like actually like personally either contribute or like ourselves build tools that allow people to solve problems in their lives with Bitcoin. And like, one of the biggest drivers for Bitcoin adoption right now is number go up. It always has been, and it will continue to be for a long time. And you, like, no amount of improving like wallet UX or like making payments easier or improving privacy or anything like that is going to drive people to use Bitcoin more than their fiat options. What's going to drive people to use Bitcoin is the fact that Bitcoin doesn't depreciate in the way that fiat inevitably does. And people are going to move to Bitcoin to protect their savings, and they're also going to move to Bitcoin to get rich quick. It's why I got into Bitcoin. I have a lot of friends in the industry, and the majority, I'm not going to say everybody, but the majority got into it in the first place because the number goes up. And so like, I think if people are building services that like make Bitcoin easier, they should be making services that help people kind of benefit from that. And like, obviously security is a really big thing there. I think people that are purchasing Bitcoin do care about privacy. And even if they don't now, there will be events in the future where people get burned by using bad privacy. For instance, kind of governments taking action against them, criminals taking action against them, that will like kind of put privacy to the forefront of people's mind. And at that time, if you've built a service that has privacy built into it, for like Bitcoin savings, for instance, you're going to profit. You're going to do well. And in terms of driving adoption outside of the number go up, I think it's all about like, okay, so I've got this great tool. What are some problems in the world that this can solve? And then how do I make my service easy to use? So like, right now, if you've got if you want to like kind of set up a Bitcoin node, it's very difficult. But do people actually want to set up Bitcoin nodes? No, they like perhaps want to send Bitcoin to a live streamer online, because like international payment methods are very difficult to integrate for a streaming platform and require all sorts of KYC, AML, and you probably need, if you want to like provide it to 10 different countries, you probably need 4 different payment processes to be able to handle that. So like, okay, this solves a big problem, allows all these international people to make payments to their favorite YouTube stars or live stream stars or whatever. Like, build a platform that allows people to do that, and then like package up the node in there, or like if you're building a wallet, make sure that the node is running in the background in an automated fashion. It doesn't have to be like, okay, like you deal with all of that like complicated stuff and then start using my service. You can make all of that stuff easier for the person, like as part of the package of like using your platform or whatever.
Which should be the,
I don't think I explained that great. I don't think I explained that very well, but basically, like, this stuff can be abstracted. Every single part of the Bitcoin kind of user process can be abstracted. And like it applies to the internet. The internet was very difficult to connect to. And in the past, setting up email was a lot more difficult. Now it's a couple of clicks. Mm-hmm. Like, or there's no reason why people should have to manage payment channels. There's no reason why they should have to manage liquidity. There's no reason why they should like have to download a node launcher and like buy a bunch of like a dedicated device and install all that stuff and go to GitHub. And that, like, all of that can be automated and handled in the background. And like, I think these days, a lot of people are saying you can't use Bitcoin properly. Bitcoin is going to be difficult to find mainstream adoption because it's difficult for normal people to use it properly.
Thank you for saying that, Neil.
Yeah, like, no, that used to be the case for the internet.
Yeah.
It's not now.
Because I have the feeling, you know, I've been observing this whole discussion on the Bitcoin community space on Twitter. It's like there are, you know, a number of people. I do get it. You know, the people have a sense of self-responsibility. They need to educate themselves. I get that. But I think it's a sort of a hubris of arrogance to say, you know, people should take the time. People don't have the time. Maybe they don't even have the intellectual, technical, you know, level. And I belong to those people, you know. So I'm trying, you know, that this is also what the podcast is for, is like to break these things down, to ask the question, why, what can be done, you know, more efficient? How can we make it more accessible? You know, alleviate the pain points. So the more reason that it makes me happy when, for example, projects and companies like Blockstream come out with a product or service that is easy accessible, that is easy to use, that where the user interface, the user experience is really wonderful, and brings me to that, you know, to this other point where Jack Mallers now just came out with his, at least it's now, you know, whatever, in the beginning phase with his strike, where he, in his article, also elaborates on how this process, was evolved sort of, and how he developed the strike, and what questions he had to ask himself and put himself into the shoes of the average user. So do you know Jack Mallers' strike? I mean, you're familiar with what it does?
So I was not familiar with the, I mean, I saw the announcement on Twitter, but I didn't click into it, unfortunately. So I took like 5-10 minutes before our call, because you mentioned we might discuss it. And I'm totally on board with his idea of abstracting all of the kind of node management and the channel management. Like, it's possible, and I think it's great that he's doing that. I mean, he's even abstracting the kind of the whole exchange process as well. Mm-hmm. It's like a very smooth user experience. However, like, as a caveat to the tweets that I was posting out, I was like, these are some of the bad things, right? It's like custody, surveillance, and bad security.
Yeah.
And like, Strike seems to be extremely dependent on banks.
Exactly.
And and like, if you've got fiat at one end and then you send it over Bitcoin and then they receive and they convert and liquidate. Businesses generally do have to liquidate because Bitcoin's too volatile right now. Like, you're really only using Bitcoin as the payment method rather than the medium of exchange. And then you've got custody involved on both sides because of the fiat angle. You've got a lot of surveillance because of all the fiat involved there. Like, security, I'm guessing it's probably all right. Jack Mallers seems, by all reports, he's a very competent developer. The custody and the surveillance isn't like part of the Bitcoin ethos. And I think that could pose problems to a service like that in the future. Like, you're going to, like, all of the problems that KYC and AML create in the fiat system are now carried over to your Bitcoin system. Personally, I'd like to see more Bitcoin only solutions, because I honestly think that outside of kind of savings and number goes up and get rich quick, there are like increasingly areas of the economy that could benefit from using Bitcoin. I think good examples of that would be like banking the debanked. So like you've got legal drug dispensaries in the US, for instance. Regardless of how you feel about things like that, they have trouble setting up and maintaining bank accounts. And like, you need a business that has wide profit margins to be able to use Bitcoin or Bitcoin only because of Bitcoin's volatility. But I think the cannabis market probably falls into that category. And then of course you've got like kind of a lot of dark industry, like illegal drugs, prostitution, porn and stuff like that. Again, they're having a hard time with setting up bank accounts. Like Bitcoin could really kind of solve a lot of their problems there. And again, maybe they have to increase their margins to be able to operate with a Bitcoin model, but it's better than not operating at all because you can't save any fiat payments, you can't receive any fiat payments, that kind of thing. And then gambling as well, of course. Like, right. I mean, there's already a huge gambling market for Bitcoin already. Like the Bitcoin gambling platforms are thriving. So it's kind of evidence that there's stuff there. I think gaming as well is, there's a lot more kind of discussion around Twitter now about how Bitcoin and gaming can be fused. Like one of the things with gaming is that, especially online gaming, is it's international. Like you'll, if you enter a game, you're probably going to be playing against like people from China and Korea and the US and Europe. And like if you ever want to set up any kind of competitive gaming where there's payments going in and out, like it's very difficult to integrate with enough payment platforms to cover the entire world. Maybe even impossible, especially when you include China. Whereas if you just do a Bitcoin integration immediately, you can accept all customers anywhere in the world. You kind of offload the difficulty of getting hold of the Bitcoin to the user for sure. But like that isn't that much of a problem these days. Like there's more and more exchanges, more and more brokers, more and more wallets where you can just do quick buy. So like, I think there's all sorts of these like kind of niches where Bitcoin can play a role and make people's lives easier. I think that's another area that can be developed.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to those two points, because these are the critical points. Yeah, you said it's custodial. When we're talking whatever we're talking about, Jack Mallers Strike app, which is at the end of the day, it's connected to a bank card, to a bank account or a debit card, so it's custodial. So yeah. And you've got this threat or I don't know what to call it, the risk of surveillance. What if people, like for example in Austria, cannabis is illegal. I mean you have cannabis shops, but people who go there buy themselves the plant. That's legal because it has like whatever less than 0.3% THC, so that's legal. It's really ridiculous. It's totally irrational. It's schizophrenic drug policy. But and I'm totally for. I mean, I have no problem saying that I'm totally for a rational legalization and regulation. But so, do you have any creative idea how we can how we can really make that non-custodial, the fiat end of it? Like, could that be like a in between transition, something, you know, like a semi-custodial, you know, like a non-custodial fiat fund where then it's sort of debited, you know, or charged?
So I'm really negative on fiat. So I worked at an exchange, OKCoin, and then subsequently worked in the cross-border payments space using Bitcoin as an intermediary to like convert US dollars into renminbi and deliver to China. And I discovered that like whether I was doing business development or marketing, pretty much 50% plus of my day was spent dealing with regulations. As soon as you touch fiat currencies, you come under all sorts of very nasty, very, very strict regulations, and they restrict your business. They force you to contort into all sorts of arbitrary positions to make things work. Every time that you engage with a client, you have to first aside from the KYC and AML, you have to work out like their KYC AML situation, yours, and then any other jurisdictions that like you guys cover, and then like work out how you can make a business model fit. And I'm completely convinced that anybody that's trying to create law surveillance, non-custodial solutions with fiat is fighting a losing battle. Like the reason why Bitcoin is so important, the reason why Bitcoin will continue to gain adoption is because it doesn't fall within that paradigm. And solutions that are successful are people that are taking advantage of not being caught inside that regulatory trap. So of course, exchanges don't really have a choice. Like you need to create on and off ramps for people. And if you're touching fiat, like you just got to deal with that. You've got to do what you're told, basically, or you get shut down. That said, like you do have interesting solutions like BISC and HODL, which create a bit of resilience and some alternatives there. But yeah, as soon as you're touching fiat, it becomes a much more dangerous game. Whereas if you're a Bitcoin business, not only is the regulatory landscape a lot less developed around Bitcoin and may continue to stay that way, let's say that it doesn't, you can always remain mobile. Your business can shift, you can change your jurisdiction to somewhere that's more friendly to Bitcoin, and you can still continue to service the entire world. I think trying to do anything with the fiat side of things is very, very difficult, and it's more important to focus on Bitcoin only stuff. Like users, if they have enough demand for either your service, so for example, like Silk Road, you will get people that will go out of their way to purchase Bitcoin just so that they can purchase their drugs, right? If they want to enjoy number goes up and get rich quick, they will go out of their way to buy some Bitcoin. So like it's more important to just create compelling services that use Bitcoin only, rather than trying to like work out that on-ramp thing, because the users will work that out themselves.
Gotcha. Okay. The thing is, I understand the process, the thought process and the development process of Jack Mueller. He said, you know, how can he somehow make people, go into this smooth transaction process, but without even thinking about Bitcoin. They don't want to go into 17 steps of setting up something and then here and then there. So is there any kind of a creative possibility to not to circumvent, but to even if they have, I take some fiat, put it into my own escrow Lightning. I mean, this is really just a brainstorming with you. And then it automatically converts that to Bitcoin without even, having the user knowing about it. But is there any possibility to, tackle this problem?
It sounds like you need something like Tether. I think Tether kind of, for now, provides a kind of a fiat alternative where you're not exposed to Bitcoin-like volatility. You just have to trust the Tether fiat custody. But like, there's no way that you personally could lock fiat away without giving up custody of the asset. You can't do fiat multisig, right?
So could Liquid work? Liquid of Blockstream, could that work? Like if you put integrated into Strike, could that work?
Sorry, I'm not following how the integration would work. Tether is already available on Liquid, so people can purchase Tether from the various sources that provide it. For example, Bitfinex, and then use Tether on the Liquid network. There's more and more places that are accepting it these days. They can also issue their own fiat tokens, so you could have like a decentralized market of fiat custody with token issuance. That's possible. You could have like 10, 20, 30 stablecoin issuers all kind of competing against each other. But again, like you're getting into some very regulatory hot waters whenever you issue a stablecoin. it's very brave to do that. Tether have been around for a long time and seem to have worked it out for the most part. A few others like Circle and stuff have got something going on there, but yeah, it's a very difficult space to work in as well. Like if you're an escrow provider or whatever, like you also fall under some pretty serious regulations. And if you're tokenizing whatever's under escrow, like again, like that's technically creating a security, and you may fall under some really nasty stuff in the US especially. So it's, this is the thing with regulations, like they force you to kind of consider all sorts of things that like are not particularly productive to the user or anybody really. And one of the reasons to avoid fiat and stick to Bitcoin.
Okay. So the privacy aspect of it is also, I mean, interesting to me. Like, what if the customer or, you know, someone who would use, let's just say, you know, this Jack Mallett strike would go into a shop and doesn't just wants to stay anonymous. I mean, he makes a transaction, but just wants to stay anonymous. But okay, you know, I can still, I'm going to have a talk hopefully soon with Jack Mallett in Hanoi at the Crypto Economy Conference and ask him all these questions, how he envisions that, I mean, also for the future. Because there are, you know, that's one of the first questions I got from people around me. It's like, okay, you know what, no problem. I can download the app, I can pay, but I want to stay anonymous. I don't, you know, not because it's illegal. They just, you know, they just want to keep the privacy. They just don't want anybody to know that they just purchased a cannabis plant, legally in a cannabis shop. So, you know, just for the sake of privacy. But, you know, these are questions, I guess, that have to be worked out.
Yeah. I think if you want to implement private solutions, you're going to need to make sure that you're providing full node services to the user in an abstracted way. And hopefully, increasingly, people are going to start using privacy technologies such as coin joins. Maybe we'll get confidential transactions one day. If people approve of that, like those kind of stuff need to be built in by default. And like, I reject anybody that says that there's no demand for privacy. Like, if an application is easy to use, user friendly, does everything that you want it to, and in addition, it provides private transactions, you will gain users, because it may not be like top of their list of priorities, but like it's a nice to have for them for sure. So I mean, you see that very much with things like WhatsApp and Telegram. Like people may be fine like sending messages over Facebook, which has got barely any encryption or none at all. But they will prefer to use WhatsApp for communications, for personal stuff, because it has the encryption. And like the people like WhatsApp and Signal and Telegram would not have introduced encryption options unless there was demand for it. And so like, yeah, I think wallets and stuff that keep this in mind will probably succeed over the ones that don't. And even if they're not as big as the kind of the wallets with plenty of surveillance on them, they will provide to a niche of users that do care. And it'll be impossible to get those niche users to go across to the less private options.
Okay, gotcha. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when it comes to security and privacy, or, you know, hodling Bitcoin, you just, you know, probably heard just recently that it's nothing newsworthy actually, because it's just confirmed that the Trezor hardware wallet can be extracted with, you know, some technical advice and expertise. So there are some precautionary measures people have to take who have a Trezor 1 or Trezor T, and, you know, put on a passphrase and ensure that there's no physical access to the Trezor. So people already have these problems, you know, with the hardware wallet. And now thinking about, you know, coin joining or privacy and, you know, all these other features and operations, it's overwhelming. So this is, I guess, where do you see this development going? Do you see like a light at the end of the tunnel, like for these kind of developments to make it more user friendly? Blockstream.
So I mean, Trezor is already a massive improvement on what what went before, right? So before Trezor, everybody had to set up their own Bitcoin Core wallet or Armory wallet on a separated offline device, maybe an old laptop or something like that. Way more hassle. And now there's a Trezor that like abstracts a lot of the security process. It provides lots of prompts in the UI to make sure that the user is doing the correct thing, recording the seed phrase correctly, reminds people to test the seed phrase and stuff like that. So it's like implementing a lot of security best practices just through the UI. And like that's after, so what, we're at 11 years now. So I think like any of the problems around Trezor, for instance, the physical risk of owning a Trezor can be mitigated by having a passphrase. And like people can provide solutions for passphrases, or maybe the passphrase on its own is just sufficient. And as long as the software is prompting people to do that, I don't think it's any more difficult than setting up a bank account is today. Other examples that you provided there, aside from kind of protecting your Trezor, recording the seed and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I think, for example, Casa have experimented with a solution which is seedless backups, where you're using multiple devices in a multi-seed configuration. And that allows, so as long as you're checking like on a regular basis that those devices are available, you know you always have access to your funds, and you can take out one of those devices and replace it if it's lost or damaged. And there's no kind of need to record the seed phrase. And I think Casa like provide a lot of support through their services. I mean, they charge for it, but it kind of helps people get started.
I'm a big fan of Casa, because it's all in one package. You got your full node, your key master, you know, multi-seek, your right. So it's,
yes, and that's like, I mean, that's their version one product, right? We're still in the very early stages. They may choose to like focus on one part, like going forward, like let's say 10 years in the future or something. They may just be focusing on one part of that whole package. And then a bunch of other competitors have moved into the market to kind of deal with everything else and make that easier too. But I don't know, like already, like if you ask me to brainstorm on how to improve the Casa service or like make Trezor storage easier, like I could sit down and brainstorm a bunch of ideas, and like a couple of them would probably improve things. And like this market's going to keep on developing more. Like Trezor's going to have more and more competitors who are going to try different things, and some of them are going to be worse, some of them are going to be better. But like it's just it's a case of progression, and like the industry is quite early. Like there's no reason to expect that the state of Bitcoin node operations and storage and Bitcoin coin joins, for instance, there's no reason to expect them to stay at the current level of complexity. They can be made a lot easier. And in the end, it may just be a case of like, okay, I send you Bitcoin, and all of the coin joining and like the decision whether to send it over Bitcoin main chain or the Lightning network, or even something like the Liquid network, like all of that will be handled by machine logic in the background. And all we see is like Bitcoin from my wallet into your wallet. And like, in terms of the custody side of things, like people will care, like, is it custodial or is it non-custodial? Does it have surveillance or does it not have surveillance? Mm-hmm. And like whether they'll investigate it themselves and audit the code, probably not, but there will be people that will do that. Like the super geeks, people like you and me will probably care more than most. And like if we do see red flags and stuff like that, that information will filter down to the regular users and probably kind of change their minds or encourage them to look at alternatives that are more in line with kind of Bitcoin principles.
Gotcha. Neil, what is your perception? I mean, do you think more institutional investors are coming into this space, are more open-minded, especially the old school macroeconomists or macro investors, or ultra net worth people? Is that your perception? I mean, is it slowly like accelerating the open-mindedness?
From getting into the industry now, like I've seen nothing but acceleration, even in bear markets. Like there is just this steady kind of march of adoption and awareness and understanding. So the amount of people that get Bitcoin, why it exists, the problem of like kind of trustfulness in the central banking system, like more and more people get that. And it's not people that already get it, get into Bitcoin. It's like by getting into Bitcoin, usually for like getting rich quick, they start to learn about everything else. And in terms of the institutional investors, I find just from my own anecdotal experience, chatting to people at conferences, I find them in general, there are a few people that like do really, really kind of get it. But in general, they're probably the slowest learners because they come from like they're if you're any kind of like wealth manager or anything like that, your entire paradigm, the strategies that you've used to get rich have been done within the fiat infrastructure where like inflation is a given. It's always happening. Stocks always go up. Real estate prices always go up. And so it's very difficult for them to come around to a new paradigm where it's like, okay, so Bitcoin will change how all of that works. And that system is broken for all of these reasons. And Bitcoin is a better alternative for all of these reasons. And they just instinctually kind of reject that. And also they're generally institutions because they've been successful and continue to be successful. So they don't like being told how things work or like that they need to be humble and learn. Whereas a lot of kind of like us grassroots folk, like we came in not knowing anything about finance or central banking or the economy and kind of learned from our exposure to Bitcoin. I think they do get it eventually, but I think they're getting it a lot more slowly. And you'll see that with like institutional portfolios and the kind of the projects that they'll engage with. There's a lot of shitcoining going on, a lot of kind of open-mindedness about centralized blockchain projects. like outright scammers, Jed McCaleb with Stellar and stuff like that, given like time to pitch their ideas, and these very large, very previously very reliable institutions like are building projects on top of these very kind of shaky foundations run by some fairly dodgy people. So yeah, I think you see that kind of expressed through those kind of activity. But eventually everybody comes around, right? Because if you make the wrong decisions in Bitcoin, you lose money. And if you make the right ones, you do very well.
I think people got to make their own pain experiences. Okay.
Yeah.
Painful.
Exactly.
So what do you think about Jack Dorsey? Do you think I have a good feeling with Jack Dorsey. I think he's a really, he lives those ethical principles that he preaches about, you know, when he talks about Bitcoin, doing those projects in Africa. Where do you see this going?
So I don't know anything about the projects in Africa, but the Square Crypto initiative that he set up appears to be amazing. Like it's yet another institution, organization set up within the space, just purely dedicated to producing open source code. So you've got like, at the moment, you've got Blockstream contributing, you've got Chaincode doing loads, you've got Digital Garage, Crypto Garage in Japan. They're producing a lot of open source stuff, and now we've got Square Crypto. So it's like it's very charitable, right? Like these people aren't like making anything up off it apart from like building up some really good knowledge capital at the company on this potentially very valuable technology in the future, but like for the most part it's just like these great contributions to making Bitcoin awesome. So the Square Crypto thing looks great. I'm interested to see what happens in terms of kind of they've got like the Cash App, whether like they start building more services on top of that or whether they like set up their own new application for pure Bitcoin stuff, because like I said, it's very difficult to do new and exciting things when you're connected to fiat in any way. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes.
Fascinating. So for conclusion, Neil, what do you have, like, is there a roadmap? I mean, can you talk about like the roadmap of Blockstream? Are there any ideas for the future in development? Is there anything you can talk about?
So we'll continue focusing on Bitcoin, contributing to projects that make Bitcoin better. Like the majority of our focus right now is building out the Liquid network. And I think that will continue for the next few years. So right now, in terms of, we spoke about exchanges, on-ramps and off-ramps, there's like this very big threat of if we see another Bitcoin bull run, we've got a lot more people to onboard this. Like every Bitcoin bull run, people say it's going to happen after the halving. It's an even bigger cohort of people coming into Bitcoin. And so we have the potential for some serious congestion on the Bitcoin main chain. Like it was pretty bad in 2017. Like if we have another one, it could be even worse. And that can create all sorts of kind of very inefficient market dynamics where it's very difficult for people to get into the system. People that want to buy can't buy, people that want to sell can't sell. And we get these kind of crazy bubbles and some people just can't get access when they need to. Liquid offers like a really good kind of like alternative to moving all of that speculative exchange activity over to somewhere where it's more suited. Like there's no reason why a lot of those transactions are getting written to the blockchain forever, right? People are already trusting the exchanges with custody. There's a lot of trust involved anyway. With Liquid, they can offload some of that to a federation instead. And then also enjoy like probably lower transaction fees, faster transactions, and then not clog up the main chain for kind of other economic activity that perhaps benefits from the trustlessness more. So yeah, I think we'll see more stuff on the Liquid side. We'll continue to, so all of the Liquid developments happen on Elements too. So anybody that like thinks they can make an improved version of a federated sidechain can use Elements to set up their own. So I hope going forward, we'll see some kind of third party private sidechains being set up. We also have like a lot of Lightning development going on. That's like purely kind of open source development at the moment, but I think that could turn into some interesting commercial projects in the future too. And also like, I mean, for instance, this year, we've got a bunch of announcements on the satellite side. We've got satellite kits coming out, which is kind of a key part of making it easy for people to access these offline networks.
Wow.
So people will be able to buy off the shelf kits with everything that they need, set up their own sat node. And as that comes out, we'll be launching a big update to the service, which makes it more functional. I can't give any details right now, but it'll be a big benefit to these offline networks. We're working on so much stuff, it's very difficult to kind of, so Blockstream Green as well, Sleen Jin and the Blockstream Green team have been doing really good work on not only integrating Liquid into the system, but making it more usable. I think like Blockstream, the Green Address app had a reputation for not having particularly good UX. That's kind of changing with Blockstream Green. So I think that will continue to grow in its user base and get a bit more user-friendly.
That's exciting. That sounds pretty
good. Satellite kits, I'm sure they're going to be very popular. We're trying to guess how many kits we need to prepare right now. So I hope we have enough that we don't sell out immediately. But yeah, I think they're going to be pretty
popular. Can I ask you, like, what is the price range? I mean, do you estimate?
I can't say right now. Some of the parts are still being developed, but we'll have some details very soon. I think we'll probably do some kind of pre-sales or some kind of waiting list system just to help us judge the expected numbers.
Neil, before we wrap this up, let me ask you about this Blockstream Green wallet. I'm a huge fan of Blockstream Green. I think it has a pretty cool, you know, UX, UI, and my girlfriend has it too. Because we're still waiting for the Casa 2, you know, our first Casa. and she doesn't have a hardware wallet yet. So there are some people whom I recommended the Blockstream Green Wallet, and I think it's great. You know, would you say to someone? I mean, if someone asks you, you know, if I don't have a hardware wallet but I do have a Blockstream Green Wallet, just from a security perspective. As long as, let's say, you know, nobody has physical access to your wallet, you know, to your mobile phone or to your wallet, would you say this is the same security level as a hardware wallet? I mean, it's maybe a naive question.
No, I would definitely not use those words. That is the same security as a hardware wallet. There's trade-offs for sure. The best thing that you can do with a green wallet is combine it with a hardware wallet, which is totally possible. You can have the your keys stored on the Trezor, and then another. So every green wallet is a two of two wallet, right? And the other keys held on the green server, which are activated by the 2FA. So at that point, you're getting even better security than a hardware wallet. So like it's different. I would still, for any large amounts of Bitcoin, I would still recommend people use a hardware wallet. But for spending money, a Blockstream Green wallet is definitely a good option. I mean, I use Blockstream Green as well, and I'm pretty sensitive about the applications that I'm using.
Mm-hmm. All right, Neil, thank you so much for your time. But before we wrap up, do you want to direct some, you know, my listeners to some resources, literature, books, links, besides, you know, your Twitter handle?
Cool. So yeah, my Twitter handle's nwoodfine. If people want to learn more about the satellite service, we've got a pretty comprehensive lander page at blockstream.com/satellite. And then, of course, if you're on the website, you can check out all of the other services that we have available there. I think that's about it.
Yeah, great. I really enjoyed this talk, Neil. So yeah, good luck with your projects and hope to get you back soon. Maybe even, you know, meet you at some conference, hopefully. And yeah, keep up the good work, Neil. Thank you so much again.
Great. Thanks very much, Kevin. Catch you later.
Bye-bye.
All right. What do you think about this awesome, fascinating interview talk with Neil Woodfine? I didn't know that we were going to talk about, you know, a spectrum of topics, really super important topics that we need to address. Anyway, check out his Twitter handle, is nwoodfine, and I'm going to put this all in the show notes. Please, if you love this show, leave me a positive review, like, subscribe, share, you know, retweet, whatever you do. Thanks so much for your support, for listening. If you have any feedback, questions, or, you know, for my next episodes, or whom to interview, let me know and drop me a message or write me to my email address, hello@thetotalconnector.com. And hope you really enjoyed this talk, and let me know what you think. All right. Have a good day.